the American scientists came in and said, well, you need to grow more rice. So they introduced the white rice. In the Bali rice was the indigenous red rice of Bali. That was, everyone was eating that. And then suddenly American scientists came in and they developed a kind of rice that could, was high yield, and you could get three crops a year instead of two. And it was very weak in terms of funguses and pests. So it was sprayed with a lot of fungicide and pesticide that was all provided by, you know, the American system. You know, farmers were first given these pesticides and fungicides and things to spray on their crops, and then they had to start buying them. But with the three crops a year, and they were growing this white rice, they found, well, we can store it in our rice barns and the rats won't even eat it. Guess what? White rice doesn't have near the nutrients of the indigenous red rice. And people started to hemorrhage to death within the first couple of harvests of that rice. Women started in the prime of their lives to bleed out during childbirth. So the indigenous birth keepers, the Dukun Bayi, the traditional midwives, they didn't know what to do.
You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Untaming podcast. Today it is the full hunger moon here in the Southern Hemisphere, and this is episode 42. Episodes 40 and 41 were a two-parter on Indigenous breastfeeding, recorded by our guest host Mary Francell. The next episode, which will be released to coincide with the new worm moon on the 7th of September, will be another two-parter with a return guest, Dr. Katrina Walsh. Katrina and I will be talking about fat, salt, sugar, and anti-nutrients. Today's guest with Robin Lim is one I really, really, really loved. It's a long one, but I thought the flow of it would be too disrupted if I split it into two parts. I'm sure you'll agree that Robin is an excellent speaker, and I thought she covered a lot of topics very eloquently. Me, on the other hand, I felt like I was all over the show. You know how when you get so excited about talking to someone, you just blurt out your responses to them without thinking carefully about what you say? I really felt like that was me at the beginning. I managed to rein it in about halfway through. Listening to it afterwards, it wasn't nearly as bad as I had thought. But just in case you're listening along thinking, what? Why did she ask that then instead of something else? Well, there's your heads up. Some of the topics Robin talks about are the work of her non-profit organisation Yayasan Bumi Sehat in Indonesia, the lack of love, care and respect in a lot of childbirth services, and the lack of skilled midwifery care in the world, how globalisation significantly increased the chances of dying in childbirth in Indonesia, culturally inappropriate cruelty in the healthcare system, the effects of climate change in Asia, the ecology of birth, and different cultural practices surrounding the placenta. Like I said, we covered a lot, and I won't hold you up any longer. Four-year-old Robin Lim was born in the United States, grew up in between the Philippines and the United States, and currently lives in Bali. Ibu Robin is a Filipino-American midwife, mother, grandmother, and founder of Yayasan Bumi Sehat, a non-profit organization in Indonesia. Robin also serves on the board of Bumi Wadah Philippines, where she is known as Lola Robin. Her passion is human rights and childbirth. She believes that each individual is an essential piece of peace. Therefore, by protecting the mothers in childbirth and the newborns, our smallest citizens of Earth, we may build peace, one baby, one mother, one family at a time. Last night, she had 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and for breakfast today, she had sourdough toast and Earl Grey tea with nut milk that her husband makes. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hello, selamat pagi. It means good morning.
Nice. So, Robin, I first came across you and your endeavors last year when a listener recommended you as a guest for this podcast, and I'm so pleased she did because your story and all that you have achieved is truly admirable, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more today. To start with, could you tell us about your own journey? You know, what were the events? I get the feeling there's quite a few that ultimately led to you creating Yagasan Bhumi Sehat.
Okay. So yeah, it's a long story. When I was a little girl in the Philippines, I became aware that my grandmother was ducking out at night. She was an amazing woman. She lived 97 years, tiny little Filipino woman.
Wow.
And she was ducking out in the middle of the night to go and help the neighbors have their babies because she was a midwife. And, you know, there were times when I would accompany her, and it was a beautiful way to grow up, I would say. But then when I was in high school, actually, where I went to high school most of the time in high school in the United States, where my father's from, and I had read that the Aotearoa or New Zealand is a nuclear free country. So I became very interested as a young activist, very young. I was probably about 15. I became interested in your country. So I wrote a letter, and that letter to your government saying, wow, what would it take to immigrate? And incredibly, the government of New Zealand sent me this beautiful embossed letter saying, well, we're really interested in having immigrants. And so what you should do is try to pursue one of these 10 professions that are really needed by us in New Zealand right now. And I don't remember any of the professions on the list, but I do remember the second one was midwife. So I thought, huh, you know, I hadn't really thought of like my grandmother being a midwife. She was very much a traditional Filipino midwife, very indigenous. I'd never thought of it as like a profession. And I thought, wow, that's something I might think about. And of course, I put it on the back burner for probably 2 decades. Yeah, almost 2 decades.
Wow.
And became a teenage mom and had a lot of wonderful adventures. And then at the point that I started to really study midwifery, I was living in Hawaii for many years. So I would say that a very potent special seed was planted for me by your own government, interestingly enough.
Wow. So Yagasan Bhumi Sehat, you told me before the show what it means. Can you tell me? Can you share with the listeners? Yeah.
Yayasan is a nonprofit organization in Indonesia. And Bhumi is the Earth Mother and Sehat is healthy. So we are Healthy Earth Mother Foundation.
Mm-hmm. And those are, what did you say, 20, probably 2 decades between you deciding, you first learning about midwifery and becoming a midwife. What happened there to ultimately lead to becoming a midwife?
Well, a few things. One of them is I was happily teaching school in Maui, Hawaii. I was poet in the schools for Maui County. And wonderful profession for a mother, you know, because it was just really rewarding and also part-time. And I was living on a farm, milking goats and growing almost all of our food and baking bread with the children. But then my sister, who was expecting her third baby, she was living in the United States of America in actually a not very nice place called Alabama. And you know, she is a woman of color, mixed race, married to a Korean man, expecting her third baby. She also carried a lot of body weight. So I think that, you know, being half Asian, married to an Asian, and then there's a lot of prejudice in the southern United States, and then being overweight, I just felt like she didn't get the care she needed. She had insurance, health insurance, and she was under the care of an OBGYN, a doctor of obstetrics, during this pregnancy. And she she had called me and said that she was getting blurry vision. I was at that time just beginning my midwifery journey. This is so a good 20 some years ago. I was beginning my midwifery journey. And when she told me that she had blurry vision, I was really alarmed. And I said, well, how's your blood pressure? And she said, well, I'm going to the doctor in a couple hours and I have an appointment. So I will let you know. I didn't hear from her right after that, but I also lived way out in the country and the phone didn't work very well. So she did go to the doctor and she pointed out that she had swollen hands, feet, face, and the nurse took her blood pressure and she was very hypertensive. And with the blurry vision, she had really a whole heap of symptoms of preeclampsia. Hmm. And unfortunately, the nurse that took her blood pressure did not do it in front of the doctor and did not communicate to the doctor that she had extreme hypertension. He did not communicate with the nurse, nor did he look at her chart where she had written it down. And she said, you know, I've never had this in pregnancy before where, you know, I don't want to complain, but I'm having blurry vision. I'm having headaches. You know, I have all this swelling. Something is not right. And she was just been accepted in a pre-med program. She was a brilliant young woman. And he said, well, you know, I don't have time right now today, but I'm going to see you again in another 2 weeks and we'll talk about it then. But everything is fine. And she went home with her two little boys. And that night she had a massive eclamptic event. She was alone in bed. Her husband was traveling on his way home from his work and her children were asleep and she died from eclampsia.
Oh.
Her preventable. So this is my baby sister who, you know, I grew up, you know, we had twin beds in our bedroom together. We were 15 months apart in age and we actually pushed our beds together. And then when our mother would push them apart to make our bedroom look nice, we'd push them together again. And we actually crawled under the beds and tied the legs of our beds together so she couldn't push us apart. We were so close. And me to lose my sister, it really forced me to do something. And that's when I decided that I was going to somehow find a way to prevent other people from losing their sisters. You can imagine the devastating effect on my mother to lose a child. I mean, no one loses a child in their own lifetime. Mm. And I don't ever really come back from that. It's been such a heartbreaking thing for her. And no one should lose their daughter. No one should lose their partner or their wife. No one should lose their mother. I mean, my nephews finished growing up without a mother. They were little. And now they have children and they don't have a grandmother, those children. Mm. And the devastating effect on you know, the whole family network and society. And we have to think about the fact that every two minutes today, a mother's going to die somewhere on earth. And that's an underreported statistic.
Yeah.
Somewhere on earth. These are not old people that are sick. These are women who are in the prime of their lives just having a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be that way. It's a broken system. And because it's a broken system, I decided to dive in headfirst and see what I could do to fix it. And every single mother that we help, if we get a mother with a little bit of hypertension, we do not just tell her, you need to go to the doctor. You know, we're midwives and we need to refer you. No, we take her in our vehicle. We pay for it because a lot of our mothers don't have the money to pay to see an OBGYN. And we make sure that that mother is followed absolutely through. And every mother, there's a beautiful organization called Every Mother Counts, and they do a lot to help us to raise some money for us, to help us keep open in all our locations. But I just love that philosophy, Every Mother Counts. And I live my life by that. Every mother, every baby really counts.
Yeah. So where exactly does Yayasan Bumisihat operate? You know, how large of an area does it cover?
Okay, so we have our mothership community health and childbirth clinic in Bali. I'm in a little village that there's access to the entire, Bali has pretty good roads. We're blessed with that. And, you know, in the last 15 hours, we've had 5 babies. And one of the mothers was from 3 hours away in Buleleng. I don't know how she got to us in time because she's having her third baby. There, you know, mothers from all over the island. Actually, one of the mothers is actually German and married here. So we have people from all over the world and all over the island and from other islands. We've had mothers, for example, we had one mother all the way in Kalimantan, which is really far. You have to, it takes 3 days and you have to take ferries. You know, you're crossing several islands. Wow. And actually herself a midwife, a qualified midwife. And she had such a traumatic experience having her first two babies that with her third baby, as soon as she felt any kind of indication that she was going into labor, she and her husband rented a car and a driver. Her husband wasn't, he could drive a motorcycle, but not a car. They rented a van and a driver. And she, with her sister and her husband and her two children and a car and a driver, drove all the way for 3.5 days. And they arrived at Bumiseha, and she was by then in good labor and had her baby with us.
Wow.
And of course, we're friends forever. But that's how important it is, what it was for that mother and for so many mothers, to have a beautiful experience, a healing experience, not a traumatic experience during childbirth. So we see mothers from all over and from all walks of life, and most of the mothers that come to us don't have very much money at all and don't have any way to have a birth experience that is safe and loving. You know, it just seems like it's so important. It's so important because childbirth is an oxytocin experience. Oxytocin is the hormone of love. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully you are in a loving moment when you make your baby and love gets the baby out. But so often the childbirth services that women are getting are not loving, and they're not caring, and they're not respectful. So we give a really respectful, culturally appropriate, loving, caring, and skilled childbirth service to all the women that come to us. And we also do community health in Bali. We have also a community health and childbirth clinic in Lombok. We have a exclusively childbirth and reproductive health clinic in Papua. We have one in Aceh right after the big tsunami. We got there 3 weeks before the Red Cross. So we've been there since, the tsunami happened in 2004. Mm-hmm. And we also have a childbirth clinic in the Philippines after the big Typhoon Haiyan, the one that devastated, left nine islands full of homeless people.
Right.
Yeah. And another one about to open in Palawan, Philippines, which is the location of the highest teen pregnancy rate on earth. So the indigenous mother in Palawan gave us 5 hectares of land if we would build them a clinic. So we built. It wasn't easy, but we had the funding and we built. You know, my challenge day and night is to raise funds for these clinics, these childbirth. Some of them are, like I said, exclusively for reproductive health and childbirth. And some of them also include community health. So we have people, we have, you know, services, for example, for the elderly here in Bali. We have, with the pandemic, we're facing over 80% unemployment in Bali because there's no tourism. So even the farmers that grow the oranges for the juice in the morning for the hotels, they have no income right now, or very, very little. And, you know, we have, for example, we have a feeding program for our elderly because we find that the grandparents and great-grandparents, if there's limited food at home, they won't eat. They'll make sure to feed everybody else first. So we deliver meals for elders. We also have elderly yoga. We have prenatal yoga. We have all kinds of programs, like amazing programs. Youth education, so that young people here in Bali can get a leg up by getting opportunities they don't get normally, like learning how to use computers, speaking other languages. These give them a much better chance at having a well-paid job as they mature. So
you were saying before about how, say, for example, if a mother is hypertensive, you will actually take her to the OBGYN and sometimes even pay because they can't afford to. So what sort of assistance do you provide to the mothers in the families in your community?
So the mothers, they get prenatal care. All of it is free or by donation because, you know, sometimes we have people that aren't indigent that do have funds, and they can, of course, donate money to help subsidize the poor. But a mother will come in and she gets her prenatal care. We make sure she has quality prenatal vitamins. We have donations from Blackmores in Australia. Mm-hmm. They donate 1,000 bottles a month, which we distribute all over the islands here in Indonesia. She will get her lab services, meaning that we check her urine, we check her blood. We make sure that she has no sexually transmitted diseases. We have free confidential HIV testing and counseling so that the mothers can get on, and anyone, not just the mothers, but anyone who feels like they are at risk can ask for free confidential HIV testing. And we do have a full-time HIV counselor. So if someone gets a test that's comes up positive, our lab tech immediately begins retesting, and her first thing to do is call our HIV counselor. So he's on his motorcycle if he's not on site, to make sure that there's someone there in person to help you through the experience of being told that you have HIV, because getting a phone call a week later is not okay. You know, usually our lab results are back in 15 to 20 minutes. So it's a really nice, friendly, easy service, and the poor don't have to pay. And those that do have money, it's very affordable. And we just try to take it to that next step, to never to assume that a person has resources they might need, but never to shame anyone. Always to make everyone feel like it doesn't matter if you don't have money to pay for these services. They're a human right, and we're happy to provide them. And the people that support us, you know, we don't have big donors. We have lots and lots of people who just care. And kind of an experiment in empathy and human compassion that so many people have jumped in and helped us over the decades.
Mm. So I'm just wondering, how long have you been operating there? Because I'm wondering what these families, they wouldn't have had these services, prior to you being there. Yeah.
Oh, and many, many mothers bled to death as a result of being malnourished in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And that's a tragedy that doesn't need to happen, that, tragedy that follows family through generations.
Yeah.
So I don't know what people did. I mean, I have to say that I've seen incredible improvements in the healthcare system in Indonesia in the 30 years I've lived here. And I had a baby about 9 months and 10 minutes after I arrived in Indonesia. My husband and I must have conceived as soon as we got here with our fifth child. Mm-hmm. And so we had Hanuman, and he was exactly 42 days old, because you're supposed to do a really good baby moon, a laying in of 42 days of really being taken care of and having everyone cook for you and care for you. That's really honored in this culture. And literally the moment he was 42 days old, people started to come to me in the middle of the night and ask me if I would help them with their babies, because they had no transportation to go to a hospital or to a midwife. They had no money to pay. And would I help? And I was trying to hide the fact that at the time I was a student midwife, so I had to hurry up and finish my qualifications and take my exams. And then, it was really like, oh my gosh, and I would sometimes have to cross the river in the middle of the night and, help. There be a traditional birth attendant there that would ask the family to go and get me, because maybe I could help if the mother bled, because they were always afraid. And then you have to ask yourself, why is it suddenly that the system that worked so well with indigenous midwifery care women have always looked after women forever, as long as there were human beings, in the world. I mean, even whales have a midwife. Whales, they go to a secluded cove and they always bring an elder female with them. And that elder female helps to comfort them, and then when the baby's born, pushes that baby up for first breath on the surface. So if the whales can have midwives, why is it that all women can't get midwives? And then, there is a big shortage of help with midwifery care in the world, skilled midwifery care. So I was wondering what happened that the traditional midwives of Bali could no longer effectively keep women and their babies alive. And what happened is that in 1963, Gunung Agung, our big mountain here. We have several mountains here, but we have a big main one called Gunung Agung, and that volcano erupted. And about 2,000 people died in the eruption, less than 2,000 actually. But in the subsequent year, all of the crops failed from the ash fallout on the island. Mm-hmm. And over 100,000 people, I mean, there are historians that say it was much worse than that, but over 100,000 people died of starvation on this island. And then that was 1963, 64. By 65, there was a huge conflict in Indonesia, and the amount of people that died in the conflict in Bali was estimated to be another 500,000. So Bali was in really a bad place. It was really, really hurting. And what happened was the call for help came back with the American scientists came in and said, well, you need to grow more rice. So they introduced the white rice. The Bali rice was the indigenous red rice of Bali. That was, everyone was eating that. And then suddenly American scientists came in and they developed a kind of rice that was high yield, and you could get three crops a year instead of two. And it was very weak in terms of funguses and pests. So it was sprayed with a lot of fungicide and pesticide that was all provided by, you know, the American system. And anyway, you know, farmers were first given these pesticides and fungicides and things to spray on their crops, and then they had to start buying them. But with the three crops a year and they were growing this white rice, they found, well, we can store it in our rice barns and the rats won't even eat it.
Why?
Because guess what? White rice doesn't have near the nutrients of the indigenous red rice. And people started to hemorrhage to death within the first couple of harvests of that rice. Women started in the prime of their lives to bleed out during childbirth. So the indigenous birth keepers, the Dukun Bayi, the traditional midwives, they didn't know what to do. So hospitals, you know, at that time, there was one hospital in Denpasar, and it's a big area, Bali, and people had to try to find transportation. And again, now more and more hospitals cropped up. Then, of course, the World Health Organization and other organizations started to really push to train. They quickly, by the 70s, trained. So by the 70s, the Green Revolution rice arrived, the staple food of all the people here, and eventually all of Asia was changed from something super nutritious with everything you needed to support life to something that was just starch that turned to sugar in your mouth when you chewed it. People were dying of starvation with full bellies. And this is very true. Vandana Shiva talks about it in India.
Oh, yeah.
And how much it devastated the culture as well as the health of the people. And we have a Subak water system here in Bali, which means that the water gets shared and it's part of the religion. It's all interwoven with Bali Hindu Dharma religion. So the water gets shared from the top of the mountain all the way down to the villages on the beaches. And they never had a problem sharing water, but they were growing two crops a year of this rice that they say you could eat one meal a day or two small meals a day and you would never be malnourished. But then you started growing three crops a year. So the Bali Hindu calendar no longer dovetailed with the rice growing seasons, and everything was thrown off. And now there are arguments between villages concerning the sharing of water that never happened before historically. There are all kinds of shortages of water now. And that is, you know, due to the fact that the rice growing seasons were disrupted and changed forever. And now everybody just quote unquote normally eats white rice. I know at the clinic in here at Bumi Sehat, we serve red rice. And it's much more expensive. I mean, your average Balinese family can pay five times per kilo what they would be paying for white rice. And so all of our mothers, we can assume that all of them are low in iron. Their hemoglobin and hematocrit are very low. We check their labs. We have to assume that all of them have some nutritional issues. They're malnourished in one way or another. And, you know, many of the women that come to us are surviving off of one or two servings, small bowls of white rice with a little coconut oil and salt every day. And then the good thing about the pandemic with all the unemployment is I see all over the island, people are back in their gardens. They've got their little kitchen gardens, their vegetable gardens. I know my vegetable garden is up and running better because, you know, people need to eat food. And if you don't have a job and you can't buy food, you better grow some. So people are definitely back up and running with their gardens. And sadly, so many families sold their land to buy a motorcycle, for example, or even more tragically, people sold their rice fields and their vegetable garden land, their little plots of land to pay for cesarean births. Because there's just such a high rate. If you go to the nice, clean private hospital, then your chances of having a cesarean are over 80%, whether you need that or not. I mean, I always say belly birth, or when a mom has a cesarean, I call it a belly birth, and she needs it. That is a miracle. But when she doesn't need it and she's given one because the hospital system wants to make more money, that's a tragedy. And it's devastated the economy of families. I mean, once you sell your rice fields, your children's 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 children won't have land. Nobody will have land. And without land, you know, you're disenfranchised all your generations. I can't tell you how many times I've had families call me up and say, you know, we had our baby by cesarean and we don't have any money to pay. You can't take your baby home till you pay. Okay. And so we don't have money to pay. We need your help. And I'll say, well, you know, you came to prenatal care at Bumisehat. Why didn't you just come to us? And they say, well, we went for an ultrasound with an OBGYN. And he said that our baby was a precious boy and that if we didn't have a cesarean right away, that our baby boy wouldn't make it. And boys are really, really considered precious in this culture.
Right.
And which breaks my heart. You know, it's just so hard to see families being upset because they already have a daughter and then they have another daughter. They really want to have at least one boy because the girls marry away. Yeah. So if you have all daughters, there won't be anyone left to take care of you when you're an elder person. So everybody wants to have, they call daughters little birds because they fly away to their husband's family compound. So that's the way the family system works here. More and more people are just, you know, saying to their daughters, no, we're not going to let you marry away. Try to find a boy that has lots and lots of brothers so that his family will let him marry into our family. It's rare. But it's really sad. Although our Muslim families, we have about 30% Muslim families at Bumisehat, and our Muslim families, they rejoice when they have a daughter. So that's an interesting twist on, maybe people don't know that about Islam.
No, I didn't know that.
And our Christian families are happy either way. We have about 10% Christian families, but the majority here is Bali Hindu Dharma, and they're very much focused on, it's so great when a first-time mom has a boy the first time, and then she can relax if she has more children. And the government has a two children enough policy. So birth control is really available. Sadly, it's mostly by Depo-Provera injection, which does compromise the women's health. So that's a big issue here, the Depo-Provera injections. But most people are trying to have only two children, maybe a third child. Again, because the poverty that happened as a result of the volcanic eruptions and the conflict in the 60s, and then that poverty just, and then the change of rice in the 70s, people really started to know that they could send their children to school and give them an education if they limited their families, and the government made big campaigns around that. So there's so many factors that go into why mothers die and why babies die in childbirth or soon after birth. And that has so much to do with food sovereignty and food security, and the culture, whether or not the culture has been respected. I don't think that the American scientists who developed the Green Revolution rice ever thought that it would have such a profound negative effect on women in childbirth, but it has. And had a profound negative effect also on the culture here. And we don't know, I don't know about other cultures. I do know that in the Philippines, they face the same maternal mortality problems. Indonesia has a growing maternal mortality rate. The Philippines, their maternal mortality rate is shrinking. The United States of America has a growing maternal mortality rate since 1986. Mm. So, and my sister and my family are victims of that. Yes. And you have to ask yourself, why does the country that spends more on technology and childbirth than any other country on earth, why do they have an increasing maternal mortality rate? That it should be the opposite. Yeah. And I think the answer is really simple. And the answer is part of why I've devoted so much of my life to natural childbirth. Of course, getting a mother to a hospital to have a cesarean birth, if that's what she and her baby need, because that is a life-saving childbirth option or operation, you know, but it also should not be used for no reason at all. Mm-hmm. Or just for the reason of hospitals and the doctors getting more money. But natural childbirth is so culturally appropriate. And the United States of America, you know, they do spend more per pregnancy than any other country in the world on childbirth technology. The insurance companies have inflated the prices of just basic prenatal care. And they do have a high cesarean rate. But the fact is that technology has not saved lives, because it's not enough to stand on the foot of science. I always say, if you stand on one foot, even if you do yoga and you're really good at it, eventually you're going to fall over, you know, and that's what's happened in the United States. They've fallen over. The system is so broken, it's falling down, and women aren't trusting it. And the people dying, interestingly enough, are women of color. They're indigenous women. Yeah. They have a really high rate of, they're, you know, Asian, Latino, Black, and indigenous women are the women that are dying within that system in the United States, just statistically. And the fact is you can fix that with simple woman-to-woman care. You know, just having a motherly midwife or a young, enthusiastic midwife or any kind of midwife who will actually spend the time with you to really make sure that your health is good, to make sure that you're getting everything you need in your life and that you're not too stressed out. You know, I mean, if you're getting hypertension because you're too stressed out, you need special services. If you're not eating well enough because your family doesn't have the income for you to have healthy food, then, you know, you need help. And that's the kind of help that midwives do give to mothers. And so that system is on the way, I feel like, to being repaired all over the world, because we do, you know, we are more and more seeing that midwifery care is being accepted. It's always been accepted here in Asia. But the fact is, here in Asia, we had so many factors contributing to the high maternal mortality rate.
Yeah.
So I do feel hopeful about the future, but I do feel like the United States really needs to clean up the fact that they stand on science alone and they have fallen down. And what are the other ways that things you can stand on to improve the mother-baby care and the family care, both in health and well-being? And that is nature. You have to have respect for nature. That's the other foot. With 2 feet, you can walk. You can walk for many, many miles. And so good science that you don't use unless you need it, and you use it only wisely. But respect for nature, because pregnancy and childbirth and postpartum and breastfeeding are natural processes. They're ancient. And so respect for nature, good science, good skills, I would say, medical skills that you don't use unless you need them. But still, you would get tired if you walk on 2 feet. So I would say that there's a third foot, because with a third foot, you know, on a three-legged stool, you'll never fall over, even if you set it up on rough ground. And that third foot is what we call ada in Indonesia, which is spirit. You need to be able to support that mother and her family spiritually, whatever her faith is, whatever makes her feel safe, whatever supports her through journey. So many women never do impact, if they're healthy growing up, they may never impact the healthcare system until they're pregnant the first time. And if that is an unkind, culturally inappropriate experience, there's going to be problems. I mean, West Java has a maternal mortality rate that's as high as sub-Saharan Africa. And they don't have HIV or AIDS there. So why is it so high? It's because of trust. because women have been treated badly in the health system. I mean, I had a visit from the governor's wife from West Java, and that's our neighbor island. And my daughter-in-law is actually from West Java, my son's wife and the mother of two of my grandchildren. And so when the governor's wife, we call her Ibu Governor, Mother Governor, when she visited us at Bumisehat, she told us a tragic story of a mother who was having her third child. She and her husband were farming. That was their livelihood, was farming on a little dry patch of land. But they were able to get by. And their home was just a stone's throw. You could actually see the government healthcare facility, the little Puskesmas clinic. You could see it from her home. But she'd had two babies there already, and she'd been treated so badly. She'd been shamed in labor. She didn't feel like she had privacy. She was ridiculed. At one point, when she cried out in childbirth with her first child, she was slapped, and she did not want to go there again. But she had no money to go to a private hospital or anywhere else. So when she went into labor, she didn't say a thing to her husband. She didn't go for prenatal care. And this is a poor, poor, poor family. And they're not eating organic food. They're eating sprayed vegetables, whatever they can eke out of the ground, and white rice. So her iron levels were not there. They were not good. And she didn't say a word to her husband, and her children went off to school, and she quietly labored alone at home, literally a stone's throw from the government clinic. And she had her baby by herself, and she bled to death before her husband came home from the fields. And that could have been prevented. But what killed the culturally inappropriate cruelty of the healthcare system, because she didn't. And I got this story right from the governor's wife, who was crying when she told the story. She said that mother could have been saved.
Yeah.
And there's a mother like that dying somewhere in the world every 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I feel like the key is love, you know, and also remembering that every single human being on this earth has some kind of spiritual life, something that makes them feel safe, feel supported, feel like they have a sense of wonder in the world. And that is so important. And that's what we really support at Bumisehat. And I feel like that's why we have such great, our statistics are amazing. I mean, I have big plastic boxes full of every birth chart all over my house, because we're collecting all the data from all the births, and we have an incredible, incredible outcomes. And using simple, low technology, I mean, we do have an ultrasound machine. We never use it routinely, but if we need it, we have it. And Dr. Dai is brilliant at doing ultrasounds. We have a lab, and we do test our mother's blood and urine, and we do make sure that they're healthy. And we don't just test their lab and put it on their file. We sit with every single mother, and if she has a partner, with that partner, and we show them what this all means, you know. So we take the mystery out of the medicine. We make our healthcare really accessible, so anyone can understand what's going on with their body, with their pregnancy. And we always tell the mothers, you know, it's your body, your baby, your way. And the women, all women in all cultures, appreciate that kind of respect. And it makes them show up for healthcare services when they feel respected.
You have covered so many great points here. Like, I've been writing down all these questions as you're speaking, because I'm like, oh, I want to get more about that. So going right back to when you first started talking, you were saying how your fifth child, when he was 42 days old, they were the people in the village were coming to you. Who attended his birth?
Actually, my fifth child, yes. My first child was attended by midwives. All my children were attended by midwives. At first when I was in school in California, and then when I was living in Hawaii. And my fifth child, Hanuman, we went to see many midwives here, like local midwives. At that time, there was a lot of reuse of needles. They were washing the gloves and then reusing them. And there was a big hygiene issue, which is not a problem anymore in Indonesia. We have really hygienic healthcare services now here, but there was a hygiene issue. There was, and I didn't feel, you know, there was a language gap. I was just learning the language at the time, and I didn't know who to go to. And here's a good example of not feeling safe and not feeling supported. And I met some really wonderful women who I later ended up working with and helping them in their practices, and just going and volunteering when they needed help. They would contact me. And remember, this was before we had phones in our village. We did not have a phone in our village.
Right.
And I ended up having just my husband.
Right.
And I know that that's really controversial. Mm-hmm. And it was a big decision for me because, you know, at that time I was studying midwifery and I did not feel like it was optimal, because I feel like every woman deserves to have other women with her that are skilled and can help her if something goes wrong. And my husband really took great care of me. I mean, the whole pregnancy, to make sure, because he kept saying, and, you know, are you sure that you're going to be okay with this? Because he knew that I really wanted to be with my midwives, but they were far away in Hawaii. And, you know, we were new here. We'd been here basically 9 months when my child was born. And a miraculous thing happened in that I was planning on just visiting Indonesia we were going to be here for 3 months or around that amount of time. And so then I got offered a job teaching. And since I was, you know, I love teaching, I thought, okay, this is a chance to stay in Bali for a year. So I was doing that wonderful job just in a small little schoolhouse by the river. And you know, my pregnancy was growing and I was thinking, okay, what am I going to do? And one of the mothers of one of my students had met a tourist who was from the United States, and she was a midwife, a retired midwife. And the day that my labor began, I told the parents, well, we won't have school today because I'm in labor, and then my husband's going to take over and be the substitute teacher for the next few weeks. And she said, oh my gosh, I met a midwife from America. She's retired. Can I contact her? And I said, sure. And I met this wonderful woman, Ailei. She walked from Ubud all the way through the Monkey Forest, down the road to our village. And she asked if she could be of assistance. And I said, sure. So I wasn't alone. I did have a midwife there. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any of the life-saving things we would have needed if I would have hemorrhaged or if I would have torn, or, you know, none of those things were there. Mm-hmm. But I had her reassurance. I had her presence. And she was there. She didn't do anything. My husband caught the baby, but she was there sitting in the corner at, you know, a little after 1 a.m. when my baby was born. And the girls and our family, the boys just slept right through it, but the girls woke up and they sat with this wonderful woman. Her name was Ailei. We're still in contact, but so nature provided me, or I don't know, by some miracle, the angels provided me with what I needed, was an elder midwife to be there with me and to make sure that I wasn't crazy having this unassisted childbirth.
Yeah.
So I guess, my husband caught my baby, but I wasn't unassisted. And I know a lot of people who have had unassisted births, and I love them and I'm supportive of them, but I do feel like all women deserve a skilled woman to be there. I mean, even if she's not in the room, if she's right outside, so that, you know, you can give birth without fear, you can give birth with whatever support you may need, and you may need nothing. I mean, if you're healthy, you may need nothing. But even healthy women, you know, sometimes in childbirth they tear and they need a few stitches, and they should be able to have that. You know, they should be able to, and you just never know. You just never know. You know, I'm always hearing stories of people you know, having the trauma of the baby's born, but the placenta won't come, and then having to go to the hospital and then not being treated well in the hospital and all of these things. You know, it's like we can just avoid all of these traumas if we can make sure that every mother has someone that she trusts with her that has the skills to help her if she needs help.
Right.
And that's, I live by that philosophy.
Mm-hmm. And one of my other questions was to do with what you were saying about the rice crop and the indigenous birth keepers, and how So the hemorrhages that were occurring amongst the women, these coincided with the change in rice crop, right? So the indigenous birth keepers had no experience dealing with this, right?
Well, the indigenous birth keepers had herbs and they had methods of dealing with hemorrhage, but they never had hemorrhages like this,
right?
Where it became an epidemic of you know, life-threatening, in fact, fatal hemorrhages. And it was, now, those indigenous birth keepers that were around then, the last one recently died and was a good friend of mine. So I don't have any more people to talk to about this. But at the time that I was newly living in Bali, I was really trying to find out from these elder people what happened and why they became afraid to practice their calling, which was midwifery care. And, you know, since my own Filipino grandmother was a midwife in a very indigenous sense, in that it was her calling. Her mother was actually, my great-grandmother was actually a skilled midwife that was licensed in the Philippines. She actually went to university way back, because my grandmother was born in the 1800s. But she could not, because of the wars, my grandmother could not go to school, and yet she had a calling to be a midwife. So she followed her mother around, and she was very skilled and very, very learned. But again, not educated in a university system. She was educated by apprenticeship. And before there were universities, before there were, you know, ways to accredit or license midwives or doctors or nurses, there is always an indigenous system of healing that worked for the people. And until we started to modernize and change people's food, the real food that people ate made them healthy enough that this was enough. They didn't need, and childbirth wasn't a pathology. It wasn't an illness. Mm. It wasn't dangerous until suddenly, because of the change in people's nutritional status, because of the loss of their cultural foods. Once that happened, and then of course wars, natural disasters, you know, volcanic eruptions, typhoons, earthquakes, all of these things feed into the history of why we really needed to develop a system of training and licensing midwives and making sure that we have, you know, the kind of care that people need when they need it and in the locations they're at. You know, access to care is an issue. If you live in certain far-flung areas in the mountains in the Philippines, for example, you can't access medical care. So these are all issues, you know, but if we support our indigenous midwives and we help them with the skills and to develop the skills they would need in the field, we can keep these mothers alive and thriving.
Okay, you were talking earlier, you mentioned about, you know, the earthquakes and the tsunamis and typhoons and how you assist as an early responder. So what does that entail? And are these still operating or were they just for the short term?
Well, for example, our first disaster was the tsunami in Aceh. Remember, it was a 9.3 earthquake and a massive tsunami. And, you know, you can Google it and they'll say 163,000 people died that day. But the military, who were, you know, on site pretty quick, they talked about just the numbers of bodies being closer to 300,000 or more. Wow. Some military people, over 400,000 people died that day in Indonesia. And of course, all the records of populations and all the community leaders that kept the records were all obliterated. We had 100% homeless in coastal Aceh when we arrived there. And, you know, that was our first disaster. And it was, you know, we learned a lot. We still have a Bumisehat there in Aceh. We're still that place that has solar lights, so it's lit up even when the electricity's down. It's still the loneliest place in the world. And their population is coming back little by little. But it was pretty terrible. You can't argue with that. So that was 2004, 2005 until the present. Then we attended earthquakes in different parts of Indonesia as just temporary help to set up their birthing units. In 2010, I was brought by an organization with the help of Direct Relief International. I was brought to work in Haiti and help them set up a birthing unit there in tents. I was in Nepal in 2015, setting up the birthing units in tents. Then Palu, which is in Sulawesi, they had earthquakes and a giant tsunami and liquefaction and nearby an eruption all at once in 2018, all over a number of weeks. And we helped them. We assisted in a hospital. We helped them get funding to rebuild the broken parts of a hospital that would serve all people of all cultures and faiths there. We also set up mobile birthing units and assisted to get, you know, the whole thing is to get the local midwives up and running. In 2013 in the Philippines with that huge typhoon Haiyan, which left everyone on nine islands homeless, we were able to go and set up the birthing units and also bring solar suitcases, which are like a solar light unit that everything fits in a suitcase and, you know, like a hard cover suitcase so that it's disaster resistant. It has apparatus to be able to charge almost any kind of handphone on earth. So communications, so for the local people can, if they've been managed to hang on to their handphone through a typhoon, they can then communicate and they can charge there with the solar suitcase. We also can charge a Doppler so we can hear fetal heart rate. You know, that we set those up all over the far-flung areas in the typhoon zone in the Philippines. We help midwives who lost their roofs off of their little birthplaces, their little birth clinics. We help them to find the funding so that we could put their roofs back on and get them back up and running, all of those things. So, you know, we've been to so many disasters now. Lombok in 2018 had a devastating number of earthquakes, and we operated for about a year and a half out of 10 doing medical relief. Now we actually have a proper clinic and babies are being born there, and, you know, people are getting stitched up when they fall off their motorcycle and if they're sick. And of course, we're now all working in PPEs and personal protective gear to the pandemic. And, you know, these free community clinics are absolutely needed because people don't have income right now. Yeah. I mean, Lombok has zero tourism. Bali is just about zero. I mean, zero tourism. We have, you know, there's a few non-Indonesians living here that kind of keep the economy a little bit up, but it's really rough. And so, especially in these pandemic times, we need to be able to provide free medical care and also, you know, testing for coronavirus, testing for any kinds of disease, and then assistance with that. How do you help people cope? For example, the government requires that every mother in labor have a coronavirus test, and so that, you know, it can be determined whether or not she's got that virus while she's in labor. All of these are really important services that we do. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I've covered all of our disasters. We've been to so many, I've lost count. But, you know, it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah. Well, because on the back of talking about disaster areas, what about the challenges you face working with birth in areas suffering, you know, the effects of climate change and globalization? Like, I think of what you said about that 80% cesarean rate, just so the doctors can get more money. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of one of them?
Well, I don't think that's related to the climate crisis, but there's certainly climate crisis. For example, the typhoon in the Philippines, those typhoons are getting bigger and more frequent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're making landfall, and they're not, you know, oftentimes storms will make landfall and they'll slow down, but it's really scary when they've started to now make landfall and speed up. You know, the last two times I was in Japan teaching midwives there, we had earthquakes and we had typhoons. It's just more and more and more frequent. The earthquakes, there's always been earthquakes on the earth, but they are more frequent and they're bigger. Volcanic eruptions becoming more prevalent. You know, all of these things, liquefaction. I mean, when the ground is sandy soil and there's so many earthquakes and it just begins to, and it's at sea level, it begins to just, houses begin to fall like they're in quicksand they just begin to fall into the earth, and people are buried. Whole neighborhoods are just buried. So landslides, just, it's constant. These, and fires, as you know, I mean, Australia has suffered badly.
Yeah.
California. My daughter had her first baby when she was living in California. She was just finishing her PhD in reproductive health. And, or she had just finished when she felt pregnant. And she was so, it was devastating how many people I met and how many healthcare providers, nurses, midwives, doctors who were telling me about how many women's placentas were coming loose during labor, which is such a rare complication. But yeah. They felt that those climate crisis driven fires in California, all of the toxins, the plastic and all of the toxins of the things that burned going into the water table were causing the placentas of women to be unable to hold on through the labor.
Whoa.
And so what? Hospitals were telling me that every week they were having one or two or three of a complication they might see once in 5 years or 10 years. And my daughter, when she centimeters dilated, her placenta started to come away, and we had to immediately transfer from my friend's birth center where we were together. We had to transfer for an emergency Caesar, and thank heaven that, you know, we were able to save my grandson and my daughter. And now that young boy is going to be 3 years old in a few days, and my daughter subsequently had her next baby at home with me without any problems. So she had a vaginal birth after a life-saving cesarean with her first baby. And so that, you know, that's to give mothers hope when they do have one belly birth, that it doesn't mean that they have to have, and hopefully the healthcare system that they're in will support them in having a nice, healing, natural childbirth experience after they've had a belly birth.
Yeah.
But there's an example of the climate crisis as it's manifesting in the fires in California, causing mothers to have life-threatening complications, life-threatening for mother and, of course, baby would quickly die, but also the loss of blood during an abruption of the placenta is profound and can take a mother's life. So, we are seeing more and more, you know, those climate crisis events that are leaving mothers homeless. You know, in the Philippines, almost 15% of the general, if you take the whole population, almost 15% of them are pregnant women. And if they lose their home, don't have potable water, if they don't have adequate food, suddenly they're grieving because they've lost family members and they're still pregnant. They have to have their babies. And this is something that's why Direct Relief International calls on our midwives to come and to help. In 2019, myself and Budi Astuti, one of our incredible midwives here in Indonesia, who I've worked with for two decades now, Budi and I went to Bangladesh with Hope Foundation, and we worked with the Rohingya women who are in the Direct Relief Hospital to try to establish kind and loving and effective, standards of midwifery care for the women there in the worst possible situations. I mean, if you add to the climate crisis, the kind of human rights issues and the displacement of people and cultural, you know, racial strife and war, it's devastating what's going on the earth right now. I've never met so many women that all had the same tragic, horrific stories of being driven from their homeland and having their children killed right before their eyes and having to walk barefoot to the next country and to just refuge in a forest that, you know, that Rohingya camp, there's almost 1 million people there. And they're now being moved to an outer island that floods every year because of climate crisis. The Rohingya camp's being moved. Many of the people, I mean, there's many months of the year where there's a foot of water on the ground and they're living under tarps. How can they survive that? I don't know how people are surviving that. It's really terrible.
That's distressing just to hear, let alone to live. Oh my goodness.
I don't know how they
So you've written numerous books, one of which is The Ecology of Gentle Birth, and you've probably already touched on this, but can you share with us a little the connection between ecology and birth?
Well, I feel like birth is connected to everything, because at the moment of birth, if you have trauma as a baby, as the one of the newest citizens of the world, right? I mean, totally vulnerable. Human beings, mammals in general have vulnerable young, but human beings, we can't just get up after a few minutes and follow the herd. We have to be cared for with love. And if a human baby, if their umbilical cord is cut, that they will immediately, if that happens immediately, the umbilical cord being cut, the baby will be short on iron, even when you test them a year later. So that should be delayed. No other species immediately clamps and cuts the umbilical cord, but that happens routinely in most hospital births and in all kinds of places all over the world. That's what they do. And that only started in the 1960s. And it was about efficiency. It's about getting the doctor in and out and back to his golf game. I have nothing against men. I mean, I'm married to a wonderful man and four of my children are sons. But I don't know when men decided to take over childbirth, but it was a big mistake.
Yeah.
And that efficiency of immediately clamping and cutting the cord, it was never based on research. All of the research shows incredible benefits in just leaving it be. And so at Bumi Sehat, for example, we wait 3 hours before we sever the cord from the baby. We just have the baby right up skin to skin with mom. Oftentimes the mom reaches for her own baby. We encourage her to do that, brings the baby to her heart for the first embrace of life. You get that only once, your first embrace. And if you immediately have your cord clamped and cut and you're taken off to be weighed and measured and put in a baby warmer, where the warmest, best thing you could have is your mother, right? That trauma will follow you forever. It takes 30 or 40 years to heal that trauma. So we have an entire world populated with people that have an impaired capacity to trust and an impaired capacity to love because they miss their first embrace. And an impaired health and intelligence because their umbilical cord was clamped and cut immediately, leaving them shy up to a third or more of their blood supply. And what happens when that baby's born is that umbilical cord and that placenta are still alive and they're pushing your once in a lifetime transfusion of stem cells into the baby's body. So without that, and you know what happens in so many countries, United States, definitely in Italy and all over Europe, that cord is clamped and cut immediately and they call it cord blood. Guess what? It doesn't belong to the cord. That blood is baby blood and they sell that blood for research, for stem cell uses, for blood doping, you know? That is robbing babies of their birthright, of their, given to them by the divine creator. And again, no other species does that. Every other species gets all of mammals gets all of their transfusion of their full blood supply and stem cells full of oxygen and nutrients and iron that will give them better health and intelligence for the rest of their lives. So why are we doing that to babies? I mean, it's a huge human rights infraction. Yeah. And when the mother sees those scissors immediately coming toward her baby, her oxytocin, which is the hormone of love, her oxytocin, she goes into panic, her oxytocin levels plummet, and her chances of hemorrhaging are immediately much, much riskier. So because oxytocin is what drives the birth process and what closes the uterus and delivers the placenta nice and safely and then shuts down the uterus so the mother doesn't hemorrhage badly or to death after childbirth. So even the act of clamping and cutting the cord and taking the baby away from the mother, you know, most hospitals now say, oh yeah, we give them skin to skin. They give them skin to skin for a minute or two and they clamp and cut that cord while that's happening. And so the mother does go into panic and then babies don't understand time, right? So when you take a baby away from his or her mother and you put that baby in a plastic box, you don't have a baby that's thinking, well, by and by, I'll see my mom again. I'll be okay. No, that baby does not understand time. That baby, all that baby knows is that everything I know, my whole universe, it's gone. and I'm in this plastic box and I'm alone and I'm scared. And the air that I'm breathing is such a different experience than I was an underwater creature just moments ago. You know, these rough blankets on my skin, if you feel the amniotic sac, how soft it is, it makes silk feel rough, you know, and that baby went from this incredible, friendly, in the mother environment and then squeezed into the world and then rudely taken away. And all that baby can do is go into despair. And in order to survive, the baby shuts down. And that opening up process is, most of us are still in it. You know, I remember sometime in my late 40s, early 50s, suddenly feeling like the sun was shining in the world and that I could feel how much love that was available to me. And I feel like at that time, my birth trauma was starting to go away. And I was born in a military hospital. My mother was in shock. She had no idea that they did this to people because her mother was a midwife. Yeah. You know, she had no idea that babies were taken away and that their cords were cut immediately. She had no idea that they would give her injections to prevent her from breastfeeding.
Oh.
I mean, it's such a broken system. Mm. And I mean, the Maori Health Act, you know, when Maori children were taken from their mothers in hospitals and then they were given infant formula. And then Maori mothers were prevented from breastfeeding because it was considered to be safer and better for their children to have the government provided infant formula. Mm-hmm. And that infant formula was causing babies to die. I mean, I have a friend that's a Maori elder, and in his generation, in his grandmother's generation, there were 21 cousins and siblings, and she's the only one that survived because her mother illegally breastfed her.
Illegally breastfed. Oh my goodness.
It's the Maori Health Act and when it was established in the 1900s. Be sure to check that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's horrible. Continuing on from what you were saying about the delaying of the umbilical cord and like the placenta, because you've written, one of your books is Placenta, the Forgotten Chakra, and you share different cultural practices involving the placenta. Could you share a couple of those with us before we wrap things up?
Oh, yeah. Well, like, for example, in Bali, every single child's placenta, every human being, of course, you didn't get here as a mammal. You didn't get here without having a placenta. That placenta is considered the physical body of your guardian angel. So people always say to me, angels, but, you know, you all have one. And at the time of your birth, over the next few minutes, sometimes hours, the placenta goes through a slow and gentle dying process as the baby's taking human life and life on earth or life outside the womb. So that placenta is then honored. After the placenta is severed from the baby, you know, sometimes we burn the cord off, sometimes we clamp and cut, depending on the family's choice. And then that placenta in Bali gets washed. And then it gets put in a coconut. And then the family will put little offerings, Hindu offerings. And it depends on their faith, you know, depending on what their faith is. I know that when my son was born here, the Hindu family that we live with, we still live in this family compound. They encouraged my husband to like put a prayer in there. So he wrote a prayer out. They said, oh, put the ball pen in there so he'll be a writer. And they know my husband's a musician. So they said, well, you got to put something in there so he'll have music. So my husband put a guitar pick in there. And believe me, this kid, he's through and through a musician. He can play any instrument, sing. He's got almost perfect pitch. They put a little bit of rice in there so the baby will always grow up with enough food to eat. They put a little cookie in there because they want the child to grow up with personality. I mean, all of these things go into the coconut with the washed placenta, and then that gets wrapped in the black sago palm fiber, which is a sacred, that's how we make the roofs of temples. And then it gets wrapped in a white cloth, a little yellow cloth over that. So it's got red, which is the blood of the placenta, which is sacred, the black, the yellow, and the white. And then that gets buried. All the boys, the first home in the family compound is where you do this. All the boys are buried on the right and all the girls on the left. And for example, we're in the new moon now. So it's new moon. So today, my son's placental burial site and all the boys born in this family on one side and all the girls on the left, there where we bury our placentas, they will get offerings, little tiny, you know, like made out of palm frond and flowers, and they'll get offerings put there for their placental angels. Every new moon, every full moon, and every Kachankliwan, which is a day of cleansing of demons, and any special time, and any time that the baby has a birthday or an Otonon, which is your Balinese birthday, because we go by the moon calendar here. You know, any celebration, someone in the family gets married, all the placentas get a little offering because we're honoring the angels. Now, we know the angels aren't there. That's just where their bodies are buried. The angels are with you in spirit and stay with you for your entire life. And when your life is over, the angel of the placenta will go with you to the afterlife and testify about what kind of person you were. Were you a loving person? Were you a kind person? Did you keep the promises you made for this lifetime? So it's really important. Every Balinese child says a little prayer in the morning when they wake up, thanking their placental angel for keeping them safe all night. And in the night before they go to bed, they'll say to their placental angel, please be sure to love and protect me and guide me. So, and give me good dreams. And this is a place where, you know, just down the road at the Monkey Forest, you know, that not too long ago, there were tigers and we had barking deer and, you know, there were all kinds of things, poisonous snakes and drowning in the river. There's so many ways that a person could die. Even in the natural world, that your placental angel would help you to protect you from those things. So
that's beautiful.
The big responsibility to be a placenta.
Yeah.
I know, like my mother's placenta in the Philippines was put in a coconut, and then that coconut was tied up in a high tree so that her spirit could be free and fly, and that hopefully the birds would come and eat part of it and take her spirit, you know, into a more free love, more a place where she could be free and be have an expanded life, an expanded heart and mind. So that's a pretty amazing, you know, my placenta got thrown in the medical waste at the military hospital, and my mom couldn't get it back. They wouldn't give it to her.
Aww.
So, yeah. And most children born in the modern world now, they have no idea where their placenta is. And if you tell a Balinese person that, if people will say to you, it used to be a common question. People are a little shyer about asking this. They don't ask Westerners this anymore because they always get kind of a look of disbelief. But when we were first here almost 30 years ago, we're going on our 30th year now of being here in Bali as a family. But people would ask you, where was your placenta buried? You know, because that's your home. And you know, if you said, well, I don't know. I mean, the hospital threw it in the medical waste. It was probably incinerated. They look at you in shock and they'll shake their heads. And I've actually seen elder people cry when you tell them that you don't know where your placenta went. Because that would be such a huge trauma on your soul. And how could your placenta, without being honored, stay with you and guide you and protect you for the rest of your life? I mean, I've heard people say, oh, they shake their heads and say, well, that must be why Americans have so much mental health issues, because they don't have their placenta. So it would be a good thing to ask the Maori people there in Aotearoa what happened to their placentas and if their culture surrounding their placenta was preserved, because every culture had something that they did with a placenta, something important, some way of honoring that very important. It's not just a hunk of meat. You know, it's the organ of Genesis. It's so important. And it's genetically identical to the child, to the baby.
Everybody makes sense. Twin.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you have an identical twin, there's no one else that's genetically identical to you. So it's very important, and it's very important to bury it and return it to the Earth Mother, according to culture, my mom's culture and Balinese culture as well. It's very important to return it to the Earth Mother. And my son, for example, having grown up here in Bali and being born here, I can remember the first time he went to the United States by himself to go off to college. And, you know, we prayed in the family temple together. We sat there. And then the Balinese grandmothers here gave him offerings for his placenta. And he went and sat where his placenta was. And I sat there for a minute with him. And then I left him alone to have his privacy because he was in tears. Because for him to leave where his placenta was buried was hard. It was difficult. You know, he was raised here in this culture.
It symbolizes where his home is. That's like what you were saying before about the Māori people. They they tend to bury it as well. I don't know a whole lot about the custom, but they tend to bury it, and that's like their sacred sort of, that's their homeland. So having to move off that land is devastating because they're leaving part of themselves behind.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it should be. That's how it would be. Well, it would be great when we all reinvent ourselves culturally and we all live with that much sacred respect for the earth as part of ourselves. I mean, you know, I keep saying that I don't believe that we have any hope of saving this planet until we treat newborns and mothers better and families better. But, you know, with that newborn, if you have a child that doesn't have trauma at birth, that went immediately skin to skin for the first embrace of the mother and had plenty of time to learn to breastfeed with mommy, and you know, the placenta was still attached, and then all of their childhood ceremonies had to do with honoring the earth mother, which all of them do in Balinese culture and for sure in my mother's culture in the Philippines, and then that person becomes a keeper of the earth because that person, it's so ingrained in them. You know, that person is not going to grow up and start a big business that's going to pump horrible pollutants into the ocean and you know, burn down trees and do terrible things, you know, pump horrible pollutants into the air and the environment. That person's going to grow up to be a member of society that builds peace and that fosters beauty and not just survival, but a thriving society.
Yeah.
And those are I'm looking around this village and I'm seeing these children grow up. Just last month, there were two young women who I received into the world and they had their babies. So I had that opportunity dozens of times now where a baby that I received into the world grew up and then I got to receive their child and their children into the world. That is such a rewarding experience. But then, you know, I look around at this village and how this childbirth project and this healthcare project, and we have a youth center where we give children an opportunity to have, you know, get higher education in ways that they really like, which not just computer and languages, but also dance and culture and filmmaking and songwriting and all those things are included in our youth education programs, which have been pretty much on hold since the pandemic. We're just getting going again. And I look around this village and I see things like, for example, our soccer team, our young men on the soccer team, they came over to the clinic office and they said, you know, we need new uniforms. Is there any way you can help us? And I said, well, yeah, we'll pay for them. And I said, I'm sure our donors would love to pay for them. Like, you know, what do you want? You know, and the soccer team got to choose their colors and what their new uniforms would look like. And you know what they asked for? They asked for bright yellow uniforms with great big Bumi Sehat logos, which is a woman giving birth. So on the front of their shirt, giant logos of a woman giving birth. Now, what soccer team in the world has that? You know, that's something that, you know, full of young men that were born without trauma, and most of them were born with our midwives or with me. And most of them are incredibly peace-loving and environmentally aware people. You know, I look at my own children, and I mean, my daughter and her husband, who's Balinese, they've just completed and released a film called Pulau Plastic. It's a documentary on the plastic problems all around Indonesia and the islands here and how that affects our health and how that affects our environment. And it had a major release in theaters here. That's only the 12th time in Indonesian history that a documentary film was released in a major through the theater system. So, you know, I know it's working because I see these young people growing up. You know, I'm a grandmother midwife now. So I see how we're making earth walkers and earth protectors. And, you know, it's to me so satisfying, and it's exciting. And there's research saying that too. And we're trying to contribute to that research by keeping really good data and making sure to do our studies and so that, you know, we can prove that not only is it safer to give birth with love and compassion and culturally appropriateness, but it enhances life. We want these babies born now to have optimal lives, and we don't have any more time on Earth. We can't wait for the next and the next and the next generation to be Earth keepers. We need for the children already born to take better care of the Earth, because my generation honestly has failed. There are those of us that really care and are really doing our part, but that's few and far between. But I'm seeing this younger generation just really, they're going to really make the changes needed to heal the planet.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. I'm going to ask you for the name of that documentary again, because I'll put links in the show notes to your website and to that. Yeah.
Okay. I can email you.
Yeah. Is there anywhere else you recommend if people would like to more to get in contact with you, or maybe to help become a donor?
Oh yeah, that would be great. So Bumi Say Hi has a website, www.umishat.org. And then my personal website, which you can donate to Bumi Say Hot, there's a link through my website, and it's iburobin.com. And there are books, actually, all the books in Bahasa Indonesia are free. And then there's books that people can buy. They can buy my books on my website. But also, for example, we've just released through both the websites, both in English and in Indonesian language, a book on Demam Berdarah, dengue fever, so that people that are in areas where dengue is endemic can get free and incredible information on how to be healthy through, you know, through the experience of dengue, which is not a fun experience. So people can get the facts. And my one of my passions, besides, of course, protecting mothers and babies and families, but is to give people autonomy in healthcare. You know, I mean, a woman can go to an apotheke, a pharmacy, and buy a pregnancy test, and she can just privately know if she's pregnant or not. But for example, people have to go to a healthcare facility to find out if they have the COVID virus, which fortunately, because you have an incredible female leadership in your country because of your prime minister, you're really blessed, Jacinta, I have to say. The United States did not have that. India hasn't got that. Europe didn't get that. And for the most part, the places where they've really been able to, and it hasn't been fun to be shut down, but it sure is nice that you didn't have so many deaths the way we've had. But people can't just get a COVID-19 test. And I know that people are afraid. They don't want to get put into quarantine, into like a government quarantine facility. But if they could find out by themselves if this is just a normal flu, or if they have COVID-19, if they could find out by themselves without having to spend a lot of money or to go to a healthcare facility and then get put in a scary quarantine situation, there would be less spread of the virus, because people could just find out and they could put themselves in isolation. So what happens is they stay in circulation and they don't go and find out what they have until it's too late and they've already infected lots of people. So there's so many ways that, you know, we can improve healthcare. And I feel like by empowering people and giving them autonomy and, you know, helping them to make wise choices, people are incredibly intelligent and they're incredibly ethical, and in my experience, and for the most part, people are compassionate, and they want to do the best for their families, for their society. So, if we help empower people with knowledge, so the free books that I have up online in Bahasa Indonesia are like Ibu Alami, which is Natural Mother, and it helps to empower the mother to have the information she needs. Bidan Alami, Natural Midwife, so that the midwives can practice in a way that's more loving and more respectful, and also evidence-based. You know, we have great research now that when you tell midwives, well, the way you were taught to clamp and cut the cord immediately was wrong. It's not okay for babies. It's not good for babies and mothers at all. In fact, it harms them. And when you, as a healthcare provider, you take an oath, we all take an oath, never do harm, but yet we're taught how to do harm. And it's all within the medical system, and that's why it's a broken system. But so we have a book on, you know, to help midwives never do harm, and to help midwives enjoy being a midwife more, because when you're not doing harm, you end up being happier, healthier, and you live longer in your profession. We have one exclusive breastfeeding dude. It's us exclusive dong. It's a book for dads, new dads, on how to support breastfeeding. And we, because especially when the women marry to the husband's family compound, to make sure that all of his aunts and his mother and all of his relatives read the book as well, so that they support the young mother in breastfeeding instead of taking the baby and giving the baby a bottle, thinking they're helping out. So, yeah. And we have Anak Alami, natural child, which is, you know, what is a normal temperature for a baby? You know, when you buy a hand phone or a computer, you get a manual. But when you get a child, you know, you don't know what normal baby poop looks like. You have to learn these things. And fortunately, if you have elders, if you have grandparents within your family unit, it's amazing, because they'll teach you all of that. You know, the manual for how to be an effective and a good parent is in the elders. And unfortunately, we're separated from our elders. I mean, I'm lucky because we have four generations living at home here, but most people don't have that. So many young families, it's just, you know, it's just the mother and hopefully they've got a partner, a mother and her partner, and then the baby, and they don't know what to do. I was really fortunate because when I had my first baby, I was a teenager, and I had my mother and I had my grandmother. My Filipino grandmother had come to live nearby us, or with my mom and my father. So, and you know, with our family. So I had this multi-generational experience of being able to be taught how to be a wonderful mother. And I think my daughter's in Hawaii right now, and Hawaii Film Commission is supporting the making of her film. She's doing a film on child abuse and a very heartbreaking and yet a story of redemption. That's happening right now. She's shooting that film. Yeah. And I feel like it's able to be that kind of person because of the kind of birth and breastfeeding and childhood that she had in a multi-generational family.
That multi-generational family it's so key to I guess overcoming what we're trapped with at the moment with our nuclear family ideals, where you're struggling on your own.
Trying to pay the rent or make a payment on the land and the home that you live in. You know, everybody in America that I know is one paycheck away from being homeless. And with the pandemic and so much loss of livelihood, last year when I was in the United States for that month to receive my granddaughter into the world, I was shocked at how many homeless people there are. In areas where you would see very, very little homelessness, it's an epidemic of homelessness. And, and with the climate crisis, it makes it so dangerous. I mean, my daughter lives in Austin, Texas, and they had record-breaking blizzard weather unseasonably a few months ago. And now they're going to have a record-breaking hot, hot summer. How do people survive that when they live in a breaking down tent under a freeway? It's just terrible. And you see the churches trying to feed people. The police are out there giving them masks to try to protect them from the virus and the numbers of deaths in that area from the coronavirus are still staggering. Again, you know, we live in a world that's so broken, but I feel so excited about the opportunity we each have as individuals to do something to contribute to the greater good. And I mean, I just want every single mother and father and parent out there. And, you know, some families have two mothers, some families have two dads, you know, whatever your family unit looks like, I want you to know that this is the most important work on earth. This is how you should be called world peace and environmental executives, because by taking good care of that next generation, you are the only, you're holding the promise for the future of this earth. We're facing an extinction level process here of, you know, the earth dying, of climate crisis, of conflict, and now pandemic. You know, but I feel like it's in the hands of the families. It's in the hands of the young parents. It's in the hands of the elders who are really have an opportunity to, you know, don't feel like you're a burden. Go ahead and live with your family. Live with those younger generation. Let them take care of you, and you teach them how to be better human beings, how to live optimally on the planet. You know, teach them how to make bread. Teach them how to grow vegetables. And that's what my grandmother taught me. And, you know, I feel like it made me a better person, and it has made my children and my grandchildren. I mean, my husband and I, we don't babysit our grandchildren. Well, it's not called babysitting. It's called living your life. And our grandchildren are all with us. You know, it's like last night we went to bed with my granddaughter because my daughter was out there working, you know, working late on the script for her next film. And we just said to her when she called up and she said, I could work later. I could come home. We said, look, we're fine. You know, we've got Rimba with us. She's fine. And, you know, my grandson Bear, I got up by 2-3 in the morning to be at childbirth, but I didn't go to bed right away when I came home at dawn because I wanted to be with my grandson Bear because he helps me make herbal medicine for my mother every morning. So he makes that for his great grandmother. And right now, I know it sounds crazy, but my mother's had 2 strokes, but she's in perfect health. But part of why she's in perfect health, and I know a lot of people will think I'm completely insane and will never contribute a dime to Bumi Sehat when they hear this. My daughter, who's breastfeeding her baby, who's now 11 months old, every day she pumps a little milk, which I put in my mother's smoothies. So my mother is getting some of her granddaughter's milk with the stem cells from her every day.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Wow.
You know, 2 of my brothers know about it, and 1 of my brothers would be mortified. So I'm just not telling him.
Oh, good on you. It's fantastic.
Yes, and my granddaughter has just shown up, and she is beautiful. Hi, Rimba. Oh, Rimba wants to know if she can see you. If you can.
Okay, I'll turn it on.
Okay.
Hi. Look, how old are you?
How old are you, Rimba?
5. Oh, that's the same age as my son.
Oh, great. Well, maybe you'll visit us someday and see him.
Oh, I would love to.
Can I see him?
He's not here. He's gone out fishing with his dad and his little sister.
Oh, what a great thing to do, go fishing.
Yeah.
Where do you live?
We live in New Zealand. Do you know where that is?
You have one friend in New Zealand. His name is Ash.
So are you here to help your, what do you call, is it grandma or another name?
Lola.
Lola.
Lola. Oh, Lola. Yeah.
Yeah. Means grandmother in the Filipino languages.
Oh, beautiful.
And she's my chuchu, my granddaughter.
Chuchu
Rimba. Hey. Rimba is her name. It means the forest.
Oh, that's a nice name. So I'll wrap this up then and let you go. I'm so pleased to have spoken to you today. Thank you so much for taking the time. I'm glad we finally got around to it.
Yeah. I didn't think you would be too upset, but we had a mom that was... She really needed all of us. There were 4 midwives in the room, and she needed every one of us. And she's a great postpartum. She was just really traumatized in her first birth experience. So it took a lot for her to trust and let go and to feel, you know. And she gave birth squatting on the floor, you know, in the birth room. Her way, everything she wanted. And she keeps sending me text messages. She's gone home now. You know, we of course constantly are in communication with our moms, our new mothers, and she's just can't get over it. She keeps saying, "I hope every mother can have the experience I had." So, and that's her hope too. That's my dream.
Oh, good. So that was really healing for her then after a traumatic first birth. Yeah. Oh, that's nice. I do have 1 final question for you to end on. I wish I'd given you a heads up on it, but so you can take your time to think about it, but. If the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave 1 sentence for future generations, what would it be?
I think it would be all you need is love.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favourite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.